Hey folks, and tonight's episode is brought to you by YesPleaseVintage.com. If you're in the States and a fan of vintage and upcycled housewares and clothing, give YesPleaseVintage.com a check for clothing, jewelry, homeware, and some really awesome finds. So go check them out now at YesPleaseVintage.com. And currently, if you spend over $60, you get free shipping on all orders. Hello and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Owen Jones, and joining me of course is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Howdy.
This is episode 108, and tonight we're going to be looking at Stray Cat Rock, Delinquent Girl Boss. But before we get into that, it's time to ask what you've been watching, and Stephen, what has been holding your interest? Because for myself, I've seen a fair bit this week, but it all sort of ties into our feature presentation, with the exception of Dario Argento's opera, which has obviously nothing to do with it, but something I was planning on subjecting you to at some point.
I don't mind a bit of Dario Argento. Well, I've got a couple of things. Both Shaw brothers. One of them I actually watched some time ago, but I forgot to talk about it, and it was kind of cool. So it's 1976's The Web of Death. It's one of these, I think, what I got, a psychedelic Shaw Brothers romp.
There's a few of those.
There are, but it's in that sort of mid-70s wheelhouse of it's basically a, you know, a classic inter-clan warfare movie, but yeah. There is a, basically there's a magic radioactive spider that makes the same noise as an elephant and has superpowers, and then it sort of appears at the beginning, and then it sort of becomes a secret of one of the clans, and then the film decides to be sort of Romeo and Juliet, with sort of a love happening between two people in different clans, although the Juliet character is fucking unlucky and keeps getting people kidnapped and hurt and damaged. But I don't even know why I had it. It's sort of, I just found it and I thought, oh, I'll watch that. And I thought it was something else, another web film, but it doesn't matter because it was really good. And it was the kind of, it wasn't kind of as wacky as, what's that one that we watched, The Wizard?
The Battle Wizard.
It's not, if Battle Wizard is like 9 out of 10 wacky, this is 7 out of 10 wacky.
Okay.
But it's, I really enjoyed it, and I'd recommend it. The other one I watch is something I think you've seen, 1979's Mad Monkey Kung Fu. I finally cracked open the Shaw Scope Volume 2 and avoided all the 36 Chambers of the Shaolin and all that. And I thought,
Wow, that would have been like my go-to in that set.
Well, because I'm kind of saving them to bring as mainline things. I thought that sounds interesting. Yeah, this is a weird one. So it's, I believe, a comedy.
Okay.
But, basically, there's this martial artist actor fella who seems to play Sun Wukong, the Monkey King, in Peking operas that travel around. For some reason, which I can't remember or could work out at the time, he gets sort of asked to come and visit this local gangster fella who gets him drunk because he's a souse and he's got a drinking problem. And he seems to just want to capture the wife of our hero, gets him really drunk, and then sort of basically tricks him to go into bed with who I thought was his wife, but turns out maybe he's just one of his lovers. It's very unclear. And his wife, his wife sort of says, to apologise for his behaviour. She'll become the concubine of this bad guy, and the sort of the actor drunk fella has his hands smashed, because this is fucking hilarious, isn't it, all this? This is comedy. Wife sold into sexual slavery, his hands are smashed, and he becomes a drunk in that sort of classic way that seems to happen a lot in Hong Kong and Chinese stories.
It's already heading the way of the return of Deadly Venoms or Crippled Avengers.
Yeah,
there's a whole period where they were just like the crippled movies, which I'm sure is like not politically correct anymore.
It is very much in those strokes, and it sits exactly in that era in that Surescope box set as well. So he goes off and sort of becomes a street hawker. This other fella comes along, sort of takes a shine to him. To keep the monkey theme, he's a street hawker that's selling candies, but he's got a trained monkey. And time has moved on a lot, and this has aged badly, because this poor fucking monkey looks absolutely distressed to be in the film. It's really, like, you definitely wouldn't get away with it today, and I'm pretty honest, you probably wouldn't have got away with it in any other country apart from Hong Kong back then as well. But it's all right, because it gets murdered horribly, although thankfully it's a stuffed dummy, but it's quite upsetting. Again, remember, this is a comedy. And then this other fellow who takes a shine to him basically says, "I'll be your monkey," and spends the rest of the film, I think that's his nickname as well, sort of acting like a monkey all the time. But the kung fu that the master knows is sort of a monkey form kung fu. And yeah, we get back, you know, after all this weird shit, we then get loads. He basically says the monkey guy is going to sort of get revenge for this, his master. And there are interminable fights and interminable training sequences. And it's just one of those revenge films. And when I say interminable, I mean they just go on a long time. They're actually quite entertaining. The kung fu, the acrobatics, and this is really fucking excellent. Just trying to remember who the main characters are, because I'm doing it all off my head. The monkey character is played by Tsai Ho, and I think it's directed, and it is. It's Lau Kar Lung, who's, you know, big deal. Shaw Brothers director, plays the sort of the other main lead. So if you like a training montage, if you like lots of 15-on-1 action in your kung fu movies, you'll bloody love this. It's got Cara Hui in it as well, who plays the wife that gets sold into sexual slavery. I will say, for a film which is about effectively revenge, it really lets itself down at the end. I don't want to give the ending away, but the revenge doesn't really... No one really gets the revenge that they wanted. But there's lots of source blood, there's lots of action. It's just the setup, the first sort of 25 minutes in a comedy. You know, sometimes we watch a Stephen Chow film and you think that's a bit cruel, but it's all part of the comedy. This is very cruel, you know, the monkey, the people sold to slavery and all that. But yeah, it's an interesting one. It's probably one I'd never have watched if it wasn't in the Surescope set. But, you know, technically really good. It's quite long as well. It's nearly 2 hours long. They've been interesting.
That's great. I mean, I do like a bit of Kung Fu Weird, especially. And there's a great Instagram account called Up the Weird. You know you're on the right one, because it's the profile picture is basically like a cannonball on legs with a face. And they post a lot of all the weird sort of like oddities from Kung Fu movies and stuff. And I think it's a really great account to definitely follow. Especially if you like old ninja movies, because they seem to be like their main bread and butter. So and we'd encourage you all to go and check them out, especially if you like your Kung Fu Weird. But no, I've been in that Surescope 2. I mean, you've got Boxer's Omen, which is another weird one. And you've got Magnificent Mercenaries, which is another odd choice in there, because they always have like a couple of out there choices. I mean, obviously in the first one we had Mighty Peking Man, which is phenomenal. And in the second one, obviously, they have like Boxer's Omen, it's like the odd one, or Magnificent Mercenaries, depending on who you talk to. It's like the odd sort of like out of left field choice. But I'm really interested to see what makes the Volume 3 collection, especially if they include like Mad Monkey Kung Fu in this one. So,
yeah, I'm not sure they're going to do a Volume 3, because I think they're very much keeping mostly to the kung fu movies. Although there was obviously Mighty Peking Man was in the first set, but I think, are they not doing a Golden Harvest set or something like that? I'm sure I saw something like that.
They are doing something with Golden Harvest. It's not unclear what it is with Golden Harvest, because they put that trailer, so obviously they've got the rights to something Golden Harvest related.
That's right. It wasn't really very clear, was it?
Maybe it'd be they're going to put out a new version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That was Golden Harvest, wasn't it?
So. It was, and I wouldn't put it past them. But yes, but yeah, because the one thing both those box sets miss is everything else that Shaw does. And, you know, whilst we know we're very aware of all their kung fu movies, they did a load of horror movies, a load of sort of dramas, musicals, all kinds of things, which I guess won't have the international, or at least sort of, I guess it's really British and US interest. But I'd like to see some of their later horror movies and things on a nice set, but I don't know if it'll happen.
I would certainly like to see in the next set they included things like the Coffee ripoff, A Sexy Killer, or like Beyond the Yellow Line. Just some of those more odysseys, or just Super Inframan would be great.
Yes.
Because obviously we have Mighty Peking Man, and Super Inframan was the only other sort of jaunt into the sort of kaiju genre, which is a shame, really, because they were both really fun entries, and it just frustrates me the fact that they stopped after like two cracks of the whip with it. So,
yeah, I guess, I don't know. They did what worked locally, I guess. The fact that we might like some of them 50, 60, 70 years later is another matter. But yeah, no, they're very good sets, I have to say. I'm very pleased I've got them, although don't fit on any of my shelves.
No, that's the downside, isn't it? It's just, you can always see when people like got their collections displayed, they've always got them like these side-on things. It's like when you used to buy CDs back in the day and they came in those big boxes that made zero sense.
Yes, it's although I probably could put them side on looking at it in my Billy bookcases, but yes, there's going to be I'm having my living room painted on Tuesday, so everything's got to be moved out, so there will be a re-platforming of everything over the next week when everything comes back into the shelving.
How do you like to have your DVDs? Because for myself, I like to have it by genre, director, and then chronological order.
Mine's a little more random. I have got so many.
Yeah.
I have various containers full of stuff. And then I have two bookcases on display, which are basically one bookcase. I have it by brand, really. So I've got my Arrows and my Eurekas and my it's sort of my Asian cinema stuff, but by brand. And then I've got various others, which are sort of series or things that are linked together, I have in the other book. So yeah, a bit random. My youngest daughter once tried to alphabeticize them all, but it doesn't last. And then so much new stuff comes in, and it just, yeah. We'll see. Maybe I'll do something exciting.
I see people doing by color.
Yeah.
Which is like, you see that on Letterboxd, it's all like, oh, movie posters by colour. And it's like, who has this much time
to
sit there and do that?
Eldest daughter, right, does her icons on her iPhone by colour.
Oh, for Christ.
So she has little groups. There's things with red icons, with blue icons, with green icons. I don't know how she finds anything.
I would say this is a millennium thing, but it's not. It's the generation after millennials, isn't it? So
yeah, what are they called? Gen Zs, aren't they, or something?
There's certainly something.
Yeah. Amy has... I've never understood how she finds anything. I guess she just reacts or knows what Instagram is. That's in orangey pink.
Oh, you just do what I do, and you just scroll from the left-hand section to the right-hand section to try and find what you need.
I've taken to just searching, just going to the screen and going down and typing the search. And actually, it's all so clever now. It knows the six apps I use and what time of day I use them. So it gives these four recommendations at the top, and it's usually right.
it's
only going to be Letterboxd or BBC Sport and a couple of others. eBay, Amazon. It knows.
Mine's just Instagram, Letterboxd, and Marvel Snap.
You're still playing that, are you?
Down to my 11 hours that I put into it last week. It's always good when you get your health check at the end of the week and it's like, you spent 19 hours playing Marvel Snap.
God, I hope that's not true.
It's amazing. There's like there's one or two games that you'll play while you're waiting for something. It adds up. Because of course I need to get every version of the Squirrel Girl card. So that's my only goal in that game.
Of course you do.
I've got four versions and there's a fifth one I still need, so.
Okay.
But no, it's only when it comes to like the DVD labels. I'm obviously looking at my shelf now. I mean, obviously the Arrow spines are very nice, and obviously the Tartan spines are great, especially the Asia Extreme ones. The other one I really always liked was Artificial Eye, which was obviously like Baby's first boutique label back in the day. I remember getting, had a bunch of Artificial Eye ones, and it was obviously the green spines, and they had numbers as well. So it was sort of like, because we never had Criterion over here, so you had like all these numbered spines and stuff before we had like we're introduced to Criterion, which also used the numbered spines.
Yeah, I've got some Criterions because I imported them. Although now I don't have a multi-region DVD player easily available, so a lot of these I keep picking things up to watch and then I can't play it.
Most DVD players you buy now are multi-region.
No, I've replaced all my DVD players with PlayStations.
All right, yes.
I was the last person to find out you can't play CDs in PlayStations 4s or 5s either. That was a bit annoying the other day when I wanted to listen to some music. So I do have some multi-region DVD and Blu-ray players. It's just I've the one in the living room and one in the bedroom. I put my PS4 in my bedroom and my PS5 in the living room. And yes, there's been sort of, I used to buy stuff. Do you remember play.com back when they were based in Jersey? I used to buy a lot of region free stuff, just general, you know, things that were available here, but it'd be so much cheaper. But yeah, now I can't play any of them either.
I use Blackstar. Blackstar was my
I remember that, yeah.
I used and used to get, you could, for everything you bought, you got points. And if something was out of print, they would hunt it down for 15 quid a time. And this was 15 quid per tape. So you had like a 2-tape set of something. They would charge you 2 lots of 15 quid. So you would end up paying 30 quid for them to go and find something. And they always managed to find it. Because nothing like money to motivate people.
And that's back when 15 quid was quite a lot, really. Well, not that it's not a lot now, but you know what I mean?
It was a lot to pay for
finder's
for
fee.
VHS. Yeah. And the other thing was that you could buy your tapes, because you used to have like a rental window before it became like for sale, so you could buy tapes at the rental tape price. So you like look it up and it'd be like 60 quid for like a copy of The Hole, and it's sort of like, God, that's a bit expensive. And then you realise, no, it's the rental tape you're buying. And if you just like waited like a couple of weeks, you could pay like £10 for it. So
I wish I knew all my video cassettes were. We talked the other episode about Redemption as a brand. I think we talked about it on an episode, or was it offline? And I had loads of Redemption VHSs, but
Redemption was the one with the lesbian vampire opening, wasn't
it?
Well,
that's the kind of thing. Oh, they had a lot of stuff like that. I'm pretty certain they had a lot of Jess Franco films, but they had a nice, you know, they were all black and white and red, and all the spines looked good together, and I think maybe I've done this for longer than I realised. I do it by if they go together. But behind me, there's this IKEA Kallax thing with, I've put doors on them all, and they're just chock-a-block full of bloody Asian CDs and DVDs. And I sometimes when I think, oh, I want to watch this, I will then spend about an hour trying to find it.
Yeah, I hit that point where I just start gutting DVD cases.
Yeah.
Like, I keep the boutique ones, like I keep the Arrow in the cases and I keep all like the Tartan in the cases. But like all the generic vanilla releases that you get, I just gut them now and just keep them in CD wallets, and it saves so much space. But when you start it, you just end up with like garbage bag after garbage bag of like DVD cases that apparently you can't recycle.
No.
Not that it stopped me putting them in the recycling bin.
Just in case.
Is it? They took them. It's on their hands now.
Well, you know, you tried to do the right thing.
It just seems like a hate crime against the earth to put them in the normal bin.
Yeah. It's a shame. I've got a couple of things. I guess they may have come from America, and one of them was a Bollywood film that came in like cardboard, full on cardboard sleeves. I don't think there was any plastic involved. And I see that's now the case with CDs and stuff. You know, I'm surprised the Blu-ray industry hasn't, or the HD, whatever they're called. What's the new stuff called? Super Blu-ray, whatever it is. I suppose they've stuck with plastic in this day and age. I guess the idea is it's a particular market, isn't it? And most people are just streaming stuff and no one wants to own anything anymore.
Well, this is the thing. I'm finding myself moving more now towards owning things digitally than as physical copies. And I know there's obviously all the smug little memes out there. It's sort of like, oh, I can't find my movie on Netflix. And it's like, never had that problem. And it's sort of like, yes, but you're probably also going to die being buried under your collection when the shelves collapse on you. But
I do think that's how I'm going to go, mate. I do think...
I know my reading power is going to be what takes me out.
One week I won't turn up, and then in about 3 months' time you'll read about man found in flat under 10 tons of DVDs. It'll be the Surescope ones that'll get me. No, it'll be the Gamera box set. That's what it'll be.
It's going to be like an interesting entry in your child's autobiography.
Yeah.
Where they often, there's always that passage where they write about the death of the parent, and it's like the flat's full of like dirty dishes and pornography, but it'd be like, and I found my father buried under DVDs. like the Wicked Witch of the East. Just instead of a house, it's her.
Just looking at it, it'll be the Barbie DVDs that get me, because that will be the ultimate humiliation, won't it?
Just a Ken.
Oh dear.
But yes, that's the exciting world of that I've been living in this week. It's been, as I said, it's been a real interesting week for movie viewing, as we'll obviously get into in a minute. But yeah, I'm looking forward to looking at something a little lighter this coming week, because it's sort of like I watched like four of these movies, and I watched the Lynch Oz documentary about whether you've got people theorizing about the connections between Wizard of Oz and David Lynch's work. And
I did see that. I haven't watched the thing, but I saw it, and then I saw that you watched it. I thought, yeah, that's right up your alley.
And then, as I said, I watched Dario Argento's opera, which is another experience unto its own, which is where you have this sumptuous operatic sequences and these wonderful shots of Art Deco art houses, and then you have like this nihilistic violence and raging heavy metal soundtrack that appears at random moments of the film, and it's like you just realize that, you know, perhaps you're not an Argento fan.
It's funny you should. There was a bit of chitter chatter. Mr. Heskins, who runs EasternKicks.com, he was making a comment about there's an Argento season at the BFI, and he just noted that against the films, there's sort of these sort of, he called them trigger warnings, but this whole thing that says this film has got violence and gore and blah, blah, blah. And you just think, who's going to turn up to an Argento season and not know this? it was just weird to point it out. No other films at the BFI have this kind of warning, and I've gone back and forth on this because I have mixed feelings towards Argento films. Period. Like, I think, especially in the world of like where they've all been restored and they all look marvellous, but I still can't forgive in Suspiria that room full of barbed wire. Why? And that one moment takes me out of all his films.
Have you seen the remake of Suspiria?
Yeah, the one with
Tilda Swinton playing three different parts.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. This isn't a popular opinion, but I thought it was dreadfully boring. There's some really good work with the person getting all twisted up and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's some moments of greatness, but I thought it just missed the point. You know, it went out of its way to set itself in like East Germany, Cold War, and all that, and never really did anything with it. And then there's all the stunt stuff with Tilda Swinton, and it just went on and on. But I know a lot of people loved it.
I really enjoyed it. I didn't care too much for the whole professor subplot, which added nothing for myself.
Mm.
And it was like some of the same problems with Argento, where it's sort of like you have this sumptuous photography and this really engaging characters, this eccentric cast of dance madams. And then we get to the end and they do that weird slow motion jerky camera thing for the big climax. And it's like, why are you just like jerking us off really for this final thing? It's all like you're teasing and caressing the audience and then it's just like bored.
Yeah, I thought it had some great, good, not if not great moments in it. I just didn't get it.
I never cared for the original, so
I'm sure we will do some Argento in our in another format at some time, because he's an important director, and I just think always he's sort of one that I like the highlights reel. Mm. But I've never really loved any of his movies.
And Deep Red, I like.
Yeah, it's, again, fine. Again, moments, Tenebrae, moments, and some of them are just shit. But I find that
Stendhal syndrome's awful.
I find that about a lot of that kind of era of Italian cinema. A lot of it looks great. A lot of it is acted in this effortlessly cool way. But a lot of it is pants. It's just boring. There you go. Sorry, Italy.
On that note, it's time to get into something equally artsy and bewildering as we look at tonight's feature presentation, Stray Cat Rock, Delinquent Girl Boss. Nakeru uchi ni onaki で今のうちにお上げこれが最後のキスをどうにもならない男とどうにもできない女が訳も言わず近づく唇重ねる。 Tonight we're obviously looking at Stray Cat Rock, Delinquent Girl Box from 1970, which followed it really in the wake of Roger Corman's 1966 outlaw movie The Wild Angels. We started pre-Easy Rider Peter Fonda. I don't know if you watched any of those Corman biker movies of the day, you know, like The Wild One and...
I'm sure... I think... No, probably not. I'm thinking I've probably watched Ross Mayer movies, which have a similar sort of thing. But
Ross Mayer, for people who like a tiki lounge and Hawaiian shirts, Ross Mayer's are.
Yeah, and gigantic bosoms.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
Yeah, I've watched a couple of them, which are in that sort of wheelhouse. But no, it's not. It's just not a genre that I've ever really explored.
Mm. Well, obviously, Japan, never being one to miss out on the trend, obviously did try and cash in on this trend. First off, we had Toei's Delinquent Boss from 1968. And then over at Nakatsu, they set out and create their own franchise, which were obviously the Stray Cat Rock films. And unlike the Delinquent Boss, these ones were actually really kind of popular. And at the same time, have got a real interesting style to them, as they're kind of like new wave. They throw in a lot of different ideas, such as like rock and roll, 70s counterculture, Yakuza, violent youth, and even a dash of pinky violence here. Now, originally, they were set up for Akira Wada as a vehicle really for her, but at the same time they also sort of edged their bets by casting Miko Kaji, who we probably all know from like Lady Snowblood and Female Prisoner Scorpion, and she basically proved to be the bigger draw here. So the first film, she's kind of like a supporting character, which is obviously the first film we're talking about tonight, and then the other four films she sort of like became more of the lead. Which is not to say that they didn't steal a whole bunch of footage from this film to use in the sequel.
They did indeed. And so these are the last hurrah of the Nakatsu studio. After this, they'll go into the whole pinky genre. Because there's a bit in the first film that's quite violent, but on the whole they're sort of a lot more talk than they are actually anything totally distressing on the screen. But yeah, they go into the pinky violent stuff a lot more, and they go into flat out porn later on. We've talked about this before in another show. But yes, and you know, she becomes a superstar because of this, because of this series of films, although you know she has to move on to Toei to continue on, because she didn't want any part of any of the pinky stuff. So yeah, this is like kind of end of an era stuff, although they were incredibly successful. And the other films, you know, we'll talk a general thing about the other films later, but you know, this was also a way of getting all sorts of pop stars on the screen. As we watch all these films, they always go to a bar, and there's always some
weird go-go or 70s band.
In Sex Hunter there's a girl band, like a five-piece girl band doing this, which is, they are on message with what Sex Hunter's about. But it's just like these weird bars where everyone drinks Coca-Cola. It's and LSD. it's lots of product placements in these films, kids. Lots of it. But yes, anyway, let's go back to Delinquent Girl Boss, because absolutely, yes, it's a it's meant to be as you say, an advert for sort of Japanese Korean superb singer Akiko Wada. I think she is Korean, isn't she? But I think she became famous in Japan and took on a Japanese name. Very striking individual, very tall for a Asian lady. Very different to the other girls.
She's introduced like riding into town. She's like this wandering biker chick who ends up running with this old female gang headed up by May, which is obviously our favorite ladies.
Mako plays
May, who's the head of this old girl gang who are trying to basically edge out their own stake in the local sort of gang landscape. And this is a recurring theme in all these films. She'd normally be heading up a old female gang, and there'd be another male sort of counterpart gang who are usually riding around in some odd vehicle of choice. In this one, the leader of the male gang, he has a beach buggy.
Yeah, he's got like a mini moke, hasn't he? It's like, but everyone else rides motorbikes, and all the men in all these films, right, are all way too old to be playing the characters they're meant to be playing. They're all blokes over 35 with facial hair, and quite clearly they're meant to be playing youths, 18, 19 year olds. And it's just all... I've only watched the first four. I haven't watched the fifth film. But in the first four films, all the men are clearly played by blokes who are too old, or it's just the type of people they've cast just look older. Maybe that's the thing in Japanese cinema. But yeah, no one looks their age apart from the girls in the gangs.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the girls in the girl gangs are like the main appeal here. And it's thankfully something they cottoned onto with the third film, because the second film in this one, which is Wild Jumbo, it's just more of a hangout movie, and then...
There's no girl gang in that one, is there? Miko Kaji's just part of another gang that are barely a gang at all. They just go around pranking people until the end, where they say, let's have an armed assault on a cult. That's a weird old film, that is.
Wild Jumbo is made in the same year as Delinquent Girl Boss. And the first 40 minutes are just like this hangout movie, including a scene where... These guys that she's running around with basically have her drive. She drives their Jeep that they all roll around in.
Yeah.
And they're basically mooning a bunch of people on a beach.
Yeah.
And this was the scene I was like watching with my wife, and I was like trying to explain to her. It's all like, and she's like, why are they just mooning a bunch of people on the beach? Before they get into a discussion with the police, it's all like, oh, we didn't think it was indecent exposure because it's not the front part.
Yeah, to be fair, Wild Jumbo and Sex Hunter are filmed at exactly the same time, and they're literally going between, because quite a lot of shared cast, and they're literally going between sets, making it, you know, this day or this morning, they're shuffling them between. So I think Wild Jumbo, everyone's just having a lot of fun, because it feels like quite a fun laugh, whereas Sex Hunter has got all this quite dark racial prejudice story going on, and it's a lot darker. But they're literally being made at the same time. All five films are made in what, a 2-year period, but those two are made absolutely at the same moment. So they're desperate to get this money in, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this one's directed by Yasu Hasabi, who would also direct Black Tight Killers from 66. He did three films in this series. He did this one, he did Machine Animal, and he did Sex Hunter, which for my money are the strongest entries in the series. In particular, I think Machine Animal is pretty fantastic, because it's got a really great sort of chase sequence. And again, you would notice when you watch these films, you'll notice there's always a weird vehicle of choice. As I said, in this one, with the leader of the male gang, he has a beach buggy. In Wild Jumbo, they're cruising around in an old army jeep. By the time we get on to Sex Hunter, it's the male gang, the Dragons, have a bunch of ex-army jeeps. And then by the time we get on to Machine Animal, it's a motorcycle and sidecar, which is obviously our personal rider choice when we go out on the road.
All gangs have motorcycle sidecars. To be fair, I think all the films are set in Yokohama, which is the site of a US Army base. So remember, at this time, I think the Americans have withdrawn by now, but they've spent 20 years basically occupying Japan. So there's a lot of these jeeps. And is it in Wild Jumbo they find a load of bunch of World War One guns, don't they, in that one? But they and in Machine Hunter, there are people that are in the army, meant to be in the American army, that don't look very American.
Oh yeah, we have the because in Machine Animals, the one where you got the three guys who've the deserters from the Vietnam War.
Two of them just seem to want to go to Sweden, and one of them is an army deserter. That's right. It's very... You liked Machine Animal, did you?
I liked Machine Animal. I mean, yes, there are obviously weird bits of it, because obviously it's got this whole subplot where you've got these army guys who are trying to shift a bunch of LSD. At the same time, Mika's girl gang, who are also, they're always really cool looking chicks. They're like these amazing groups of like really cool chicks. And Wada is, this is the thing which makes it Delinquent Girl Boss sort of stand out, because Wada is obviously, the movie is being clearly set up for her. And she has got like the coolest look. She's in, she's clearly shopping with like the Crazy Frog collection. And she's got her denims, and she's got the big motorcycle helmet on, and she even gets to like do a bit of singing in there.
And she's got one hell of a voice, hasn't she? I mean, she's got like this, she's got a good set of pipes on her. Apparently she's still going now.
She is. She's still doing performances now. The scenes of, you see the scenes of her in the beginning, she's like rolls into town, and then when you get on to the second one, Wild Jumbo, and you see those same shots, but they're shot from, it's made to look like another character looking over in her direction.
Yeah.
And then they have all the singing shots of her in the club. Yeah. Which had got nothing to do with the film whatsoever. They just need the musical moments. They just recycle all the singing sections.
All the films are 85 minutes long. I think apart from maybe the Machine one, which is 3 minutes shorter. But yeah, they have this common pattern, but none, you know, go back to the one we want to talk about, I guess. Delinquent Girl Boss is different because it's got this lead character, and she just, like you say, she just comes into town. She sort of takes over, the gang just by, not in any kind of cruel way. They just all look up to her. There's clearly a thing where everyone keeps calling her a man, and there's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, so that she's clearly possibly gay, and that maybe some of the girls in the group have come under her spell and things like that. But she's just, and she's just got more balls than anybody else in the film. You know, she takes this. Well, she brings a motorbike to a knife fight. That's what her character does all the time.
Yeah, we see a lot of knife fights between the Go-Gangs. I think it's in this one, and Sex Hunter, I think, is the other one, that you've got the knife fight between the two girls. They have this knife fight where they're holding flashlights in one hand and knives in the other, and they're just like, they're trying to attack each other. It's very sort of like Rebel Without a Cause.
I mean, I have to admit, all that stuff I didn't really grasp, because in both those films. So the first film and the third film feel very similar. They've got actual girl gangs which are proper on delinquents, and they, although they're only drinking coke in the pub, you know, they are, one girl's huffing glue in this one. I think that's the most delinquent thing I think I see. But they do have these knife fights, which I'm not sure if they're meant to hurt each other or not. And they seem quite shocked when someone gets a scratch. And that's a bit weird. But in the other two that I watched, in the second film, there's no girl gang. And in the fourth one, they're just more cool, aren't they, than delinquents. And they're dressed very trendily. And they sort of they seem to be more like they're going to wine bars than huffing glue and having knife fights. And
oh, yeah, because you got Mika's character, who's the whole time she's got the female prisoner scorpion hat. It's like a prototype of the hat, but it's not as big.
Yeah,
and she's got the same outfit that she wears in basically the final four films.
Yeah,
she has this this proto female prisoner scorpion look happening, but in the fourth one, Machine Animal is the one where they're basically, her gang are just like a bunch of like slackers who'd rather be just dropping LSD. And the fact that they go and steal the LSD off these three deserters. I know you're saying that only one's a deserter, but we'll just keep things simple. And the way of doing it is by basically destroying the inside of the car to try and find where this LSD is. And then they were like, oh, wait, your cause is really noble, man. Let's just all hang out and drop more LSD.
And as the drug of choice, so all the films have some kind of, sort of social context, right? So the first film, I guess it's about delinquents. And there's a nationalist right-wing organisation that Miko's boyfriend's joined, that's right. And in the second film, there's a cult. And in the third film, it's all about racism. And then in the fourth film, it's meant to be about drugs. But LSD is like, it's like, it's just like, it's not like heroin or something. It's not, it's just, it's, I don't know, it's a kind of drug which is not, I don't know, I don't think it's the kind of drug that you need to worry about everybody in the world getting addicted to and not doing any work anymore. I'm not advocating any drugs, of course, but it just feels a bit of a moral panic that there's none to be had, because like you say, they go out of their way to steal it, and then they just say, oh, actually, we'll help you. Have your drugs back. And no one, there's one party scene, isn't there, where someone takes a tab of LSD, and that's about it. It's a weird, it's obviously very, it wants to talk about drugs, but I think the director rightly knows that he probably can't preach on it or something like that.
But no, I mean, yeah, with Machine Animal, I think it's the most psychedelic of the saga. And I mean, the fact that you've got Peter Pan as the band of choice in it, where there's a scene where the singer who switches between playing the keyboard and a flute and also attempts to play the keyboard like a pair of drums, as he just smashes their hands on the keys, which is quite amusing to watch as well. But the real sort of standout moment of Machine Ammo is just the scene, the big chase scene that they have, where they're like, we need Hondas, and then they just dash into a motorcycle dealership and like come out on these like I wasn't sure they mopeds or just like spin and dribbles or what sort of bikes they were, but they,
yeah, I think they're very much that sort of Asian moped two stroke.
What follows is probably the slowest motorcycle chase ever committed to film, as as they're cruising around and you see them, they go through it. They have all these like big setups that clearly when they were planning, it was going to be like, oh, we're going to have like this Italian job style setup where they go for like a Sichuan restaurant and you see the guy shocked and he's got the chicken in front of his mouth. But the girls are going, because it's obviously the actresses doing it, I don't think they were overly confident on these bikes or whether these bikes go particularly fast, but it seems just like going around, just like, and the fact that Miko's got these goggles that are almost twice the size of her face.
The goggles. It's like watching somebody in a 1920s British comedy or something. You imagine Jeeves and Wooster, you know, like, with Wooster would be in the sidecar wearing those goggles or something like that. Hilarious.
But
yeah, also kind of stylish because they're white.
This is the thing. She effortlessly looks cool in her biker getup. And the fact that they have this chase scene, then they return the motorcycles to the dealership and then just run out the other entrance. It's like,
They do go, shit, we need Hondas. Go to the dealership, steal the bikes, have the bike chase, rescue Charlie. And spoilers, somewhat fucking pointlessly, because he's going to be dead in 5 minutes.
Oh yeah, there's some point out. Charlie, who has been shoved into the motorcycle sidecar, which the big boss is, sort of drives around in. But it was a lot lighter, and I think it's because I'm coming off the back of Sex Hunter. And Sex Hunter has the scene where the male gang set up Miko's gang for a gangbang party. They think that,
or rape oh, yes, party, it's, he calls it at one point, yeah.
And obviously sexual violence is never fun, and it's not so fun in this one. No. And there's real sort of undertones of like the fact the leader of this gang hates basically anyone he considers to be half-caste or immigrants, because...
And again, and this is because of the American soldiers in that town. There's a whole generation. I mean, it's a bit weird that there's this bar where only mixed race people go.
Oh, I love the fact on the outside it says, Japanese welcome. It's like,
as well, yeah.
It's
yeah.
like nice to know in Japan but, the Japanese population are welcome.
But it's kind of, yeah, but that one's built more like a Western. And so you've got this guy that comes into town and he's got this quest he's after. It turns out he's looking for his long lost sister. And then she rejects him when they find out who she is. And there's a big shootout. And oh, at one point he's hunted through the grass dunes and dragged along. It's got this, you know, a bit, it's very much like an American Western. It's just like it's Japanese people versus mixed race people, and it's kind of progressive. I think the film is being critical of that sort of pure blood thing that Japan unfortunately still has going on today. But that's a dark film. To me, Sex Hunter. Is that what it's called?
Sex Hunter.
There's not a lot of sex hunting going on.
The titles don't make the damn bit of sense for any of these movies.
Apart from the first one, you know, she is sort of a girl boss, isn't she? Although probably less delinquent than any of the others. But yes, I think that's the strongest film. I think that's got the strongest characters. Things make sense. It's got something to say. And it's got some... It's the one with literally shocking moments. Apart from, obviously, in Delinquent Girl Boss, there's that girl that gets kidnapped and then they iron her breasts using a... blowtorch, yeah, isn't it? They blowtorch her. That's dark.
In Delinquent Girl Boss, you've got not only you've got Miko's gang, but you've also got a rival girl gang who the constant rumbles with. And at the same time, you've got the male gang who are organising this this boxing fight that Miko's gang managed to screw up, and it sort of like brings down the wrath on them, and it all becomes a little bit melodramatic. With Sex Hunter, though, that's the one where the music's provided by Golden Half, who were the Japanese girl group whose gimmick was that all of them had foreign fathers.
Yeah, and so that sort of all throughout the film, there's this thing of this mixed race stuff, which is really progressive. But they're not the sort of group that you'd see in this bar. That's the weird thing about it. Although, to be fair, the music performances in in Machine Animal. Is that what it's called? I don't know why it's called Machine Animal, by the way.
Fourth one.
Yeah, so obviously we haven't seen the fifth one, but I don't think Maiko Kaji's in it very much anyway, so what's the point? But they have whole... That's more like the Top of the Pop set or something. And they have like dancers in these high-up platforms, and it's just a completely different feel. But yes.
And that's the one with like the blankety blank. No, it's... Yeah, Machine Animals is the one with Celebrity Squares, because they're on these little boxes. And when we watch Sex Hunter, it's basically like a scaffolding platform that these four girls are basically forced to dance on.
Yeah. Yeah. But I like the music in them all.
Did you?
I mean, it's not something I'd listen to daily, but I kind of like that all the four of the five films that we saw, there are common... the common elements, even though they're nothing to do with each other. You know, apart from, as you said, there's bizarre stuff where bits of the first film were in the second, but all the characters are different, the stories are different, but they have the common, you know, they have some kind of societal ill they want to discuss. There's Miko Kaji, obviously, is in them all. You've got the weird transport, you've got the gangs run by men who are far too old to be in gangs, you've got what else was it? I wrote some notes. You got the pop music. So a lot of these things are just platforms for the pop artists of the day to get some exposure. But and also it ends badly for most people at the end of every film, even World Jumbo, where you think it's just pretty relaxed and chilled, and it's like an episode of The Monkees, really, a lot of the time. Many of them come out the other end, do they? But they are really well made, right? They've got loads of experience, like you hinted at the beginning, sort of very new wavy, loads of really amazing camera shots, some excellent use of split screen and wipes and things like that. There's, you know, there's one of them like goes out of its way to break the 180 rule in a way that Ozu could only imagine, and that's Sex Hunter. That they've got these two people talking and then the camera flips and you're completely disoriented because they're on the wrong side of the screen, but it's all done on purpose. So even though we're making out they're all a bit nutty and crazy, I think they're all incredibly well made. They don't look like
Roger Corman films, do they?
No, I mean, obviously, when it came to like the Roger Corman movies, I mean, Roger Corman was just obviously someone who really latched onto a trend and then would like churn about five or six movies to sort of like really milk a trend. And that's why you would often have, and often it would be the case where, especially with like the Filipino genre movies, he would like send a crew out and he would film two movies at the same time. And that's why you have things such as like The Big Dollhouse and The Big Birdcage. And you would like, because I mean, it's like, what's the point of me paying for two plane tickets when I could pay for one plane ticket and get two movies out of it? Because that's the Roger Corman film school. You give a bunch of hungry young film students a budget and a script and send them on their way. And that's where the likes of, like, when you look at the people who came through that school, and it's sort of like Joe Dante, Jim Cameron, Ron Howard, it's like...
Yeah, it is. I get that. And these films were also made in the same 2-3 year period. But I just thought, I thought they were really well made films. I think some of the plots were
that was the point I wanted to raise with it. And I mean, this is also why we've been sort of like jumping around between the films rather than just focusing on obviously Lincoln Girl Boss, which is obviously the one I would recommend starting with, because the plots are so sort of threadbare and sort of sporadic in terms of, like, it seems like a bunch of scenes sort of like loosely strung together for the most part, and it's sort of like you kind of hope by the end that it's all going to come together. And certainly, like, when you look at Wild Jumbo, which is just 45 minutes of like hanging out, it's sort of like watching the beach blanket bingo, the sort of beach movies of like the 50s and things like Gidget. It's just like a bunch of really sort of a bunch of cool hip dudes hanging out.
What I will say is, as I watched four of them in 2 days,
pretty much is the case. It's just all I watched is this.
Wild Jumbo was actually quite a nice little fish course. it's easily the weakest of the movie of the four that I watched. But it's still got plenty to enjoy. But yeah, because I think Delinquent Girl Boss, I got a bit bored of halfway through, and I have seen that three or four times before. So maybe it was some familiarity when they start going with the boxing match and stuff like that. I'm tired of the plot. I think Sex Hunter is just fucking brilliant, actually, and I think that's my favourite. Machine Animal, I think it's probably the best looking of them all. I mean, they all ride around, don't they, in the Ecto One?
the station car. Wagon that they have.
Yeah, at one point, about eight of them get out of this car, and it looks like there's plenty of room for four or five more people. But I think that's the coolest one. But I think the plots, I just think it's not as edgy as the others. It doesn't have any sort of edge to it as far as
And I think you'll find that with these films that they have like one or two sequences sort of like stand out there and often like carry the film. Like with Delinquent Girl Boss, you obviously have the opening sequence and how it goes from like her rolling into town on the bike looking cool, and she stops at the garage and has like a Coke, and then she's like into the gang fight, and then by the end where we've got that really amazing chase sequence where you see this June buggy like going up and down the subway steps and like going every which way. I think that's a really fantastic chase sequence, and I think it's gonna be like the one thing that you come away from this movie like remembering, is that particular sort of sequence. And it's the same when you look at like Machine Animal, it's that motorcycle chase sequence is like what sort of like stands out there, and or just like the fighty sort of sequences rather than like the plot itself.
Yeah, I mean, these are they've obviously got modern popularity because, you know, Miko Kaji's a superstar,
and your Twitter friend,
and my was it my Twitter friend, she's some
she follows you
mine,
you don't follow me, that's for sure. So
I think it's because I liked something once on the YouTube or something, I don't know, but you know, we've both got you've got the box set of this.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, this one came out from Arrow. This was the first of the box sets that came out when that was like kind of interesting because it was something a bit different, because you had this, and I want to say it was followed by Battles Without Honor and Humanity and the Female Prisoner Scorpion set. Those sort of three sets came out, so sort of like one after the other, and I bought this one as a complete blind buy. And for whatever reason, I watched the first one, and I never got around to watching the other films until now. So it's been a plus for this week, actually, finally crossing them off the watch pile, because it's been...
Which is the same here. Like, I've watched the first film, like I say, three or four times. I've never bothered watching the others, and you sort of set the challenge, or you're going to watch them all, and I thought, oh, I can't be bothered with that. And then I ended up doing it, and I had a nice time doing it. The thing is, not one of these films holds a candle to the female prisoner Scorpion. It doesn't hold a candle to Lady Snowblood movies. It doesn't hold a candle to anything else I've seen Miko Kaji in. There's some films early in this, like Blind Woman's Curse and Retaliation and stuff that she's in.
But, oh yeah, I mean, the director's obviously done other great films, as you said, Retaliation, Massacre Guns, also really good as well. Yep. So,
these are better than I thought they would be. I thought they were going to be. I thought the other films were going to be dreadful and just pale imitations. But the fact that they are all, although there's a common theme and ideas in them, but I thought they were very entertaining. But I got to be honest with you, don't remember anybody else in any of the films apart from Miko Kaji and Akiko Wado in the first one.
No, they do all kind of like blend into the other. I think you recognise the character traits more, what they look like. Certainly in Machine Animal, there is the female gang boss who's secretly running the dragons, who are like the male Yakuza boss.
Is she not Miko Kaji's sister?
Pass.
Yeah, so I know that Miko Kaji's sister is in that one, and because they look quite similar, I assume that character that is played by actually her sister. But I think they've got different surnames, because Miko Kaji, that isn't her real name. I can't remember what her real name is. But
so... Is he Bunchoku Han?
Yeah, I don't know. I read somewhere that her sister is in that, and that was the one that obviously looked like she could be related.
And the thing which sort of stands out the most, really, of that one is that, as I said, this female boss, every time they cut to her, she's got this weird sort of gothic music going on. She's in a wheelchair, and she's sort of like... they're commanding the male gang, the dragons, to do sort of like her bidding. She's running this secret side hustle with LS. What are those red cigarettes supposed to be? Are they LSD?
Cigarettes? No, they're hash.
Oh, right. Because in the bar they have these red
cigarettes. Mary Jane.
I have to say that for a hip crowd, everyone's sort of like secretly smoking them. You see them like covering their hands as they're passing these cigarettes around.
Yeah, no, you don't smoke LSD. LSD's like
as I said, I know that you have the tabs, and then you go and watch Fellini movies. But
thank you
so much for that one.
Yeah, it's like a. I mean, I'm not going to expose my knowledge of
psychotropics,
psychotropic drugs, because I've never had one in my life. But I do know you don't smoke it.
No, nope. It's. You can get worried about getting chased by a giant thumb or thinking you can fly. And it's kind of funny, because every time they cut to it, they got this weird gothic music, and then they go back to her later, and then she puts on a record, and it's this music that we've been hearing the whole time. So she actually has her own theme music that she's got set up.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah, I mean, the box set itself is quite nice. I haven't delved into any of the special features, though, and I just don't know if I ever will.
It's a
lot
cheaper now.
That's the...
Like, this one and the Female Prison Scorpion one, I saw they were, like, 20 quid a piece, which is a lot less than I paid for this set originally, I'll tell you that. Because I think it was, like, a 50-quid set when I bought it originally.
And there was only meant to be 2,000 copies.
Yeah, they got us for that one, didn't they?
Well, they always do. I didn't get it when it first came out. I got it as part of one of those, we just found a few copies in our warehouse, which I always fall for, because we all know that's code for we need to shift the stuff that we haven't sold. Do you make that? Oh yes, and they probably only would sell 2,000 copies. That's probably quite a lot to sell at 50 quid a pop. If you think about it.
Well, at the time, Army Narrow weren't the powerhouse that they are now. At the time, they were sort of like they were sort of like just sort of established themselves because they start picking up all the Tartan titles, and they put out like Into the Cult Realm, and they'd start putting out like Asian titles and stuff. And as I said, this Stroke Out Rock was sort of like this weird oddity of a title that they've only sort of added to now with things such as like the Diamond Guys collection and. Black Test Car and Giants and Toys, all these weirder titles that we wouldn't have seen before. So, and better still, you can watch all of these films on the Arrow Player as well. So,
yes, which one day I will sign up to and save myself disk space, shelving space.
But yeah, anything else you want to talk about these movies? It's been a bit of a
It's been a bit rambly, but I think you can watch that first film and it's a great film and it's famous for the right reasons and stuff like that. But I think it's I don't mind being rambly because I think they all come as a group. If they'd been like 5 years between each one or something like that, I think it would have been different. But the fact that they're basically, I mean, two of them were made literally at the same time. I don't know if you can take them apart. And yeah, you know, they're not great. They're not fantastic. But they've all got moments in them. They've all got Mika Kaji in. They're a good laugh. And if you can pick up that box set for 20 quid, I think it's worthwhile. Maybe not the 50 quid that I spent on it.
They definitely really, I think they just, if anything, they capture a period of time. Especially when you look at like the Yakuza style side of things, because at this point the Yakuza that we see in these movies, it's not the legitimate business organizations that we obviously see like when going into like films of the 80s and onwards, where it's all like a more structured organization. Instead, these are more like sort of street gangs that are being said to represent the Yakuza. So it's an interesting comparison when you look at this, and then you obviously look at the Yakuza movies that followed. And certainly like the Girl Gang movies that followed, how this obviously would lead into like the Pinky Violence boom, really. So these are like real forerunners to that. So it's interesting in a way just to see the start of a trend, if anything, with these films. And as I said, just this little time capsule into this weird time in Japan.
Absolutely. Well, very similar to sort of things like, oh god, what were those films that we saw that I wasn't that big into, but crikey, the guy we saw and he was mad and he nearly broke the studio, and the films were, look, we've done one of his films,
Shinzo Suzuki, so like the Tokyo Drifter, like, movies.
Tokyo Drifter, there we go. I knew you'd come up with it. Yeah, they feel like prototypes for that kind of movie, that kind of experimental, visually breaking out of, you know, we've things like Ozu and Kurosawa and people like these, people that are doing these very technically correct, although impressive movies, and you've got these new guys that are trying different sorts of camera angles, different kinds of things technically. Like I say, there's some split screen stuff which is astonishing. There's another one in I think it's in Machine Hunter where it's a split screen. You see two people coming towards one person but shot on different cameras, and it all comes into being the same shot, and it's like utterly unnecessary but really fucking cool. So yeah, there's some cool stuff like that. So yeah, I think these are fine, but they're all solid 6 out of 10s, you know, for different reasons. Although you probably wouldn't want to watch Wild Jumbo. I can't see any reason to watch Wild Jumbo on its own.
You didn't appreciate the Get Carter ending to it.
I just found it incompatible with the first 2/3 of the movie.
It makes no sense even in like comparison to the other films in this sequence. Yeah, it is just a weird one. It's basically a heist movie slotted onto the end of a Hangout movie. So, that's obviously the Stray Cat Rock movies. I hope you've enjoyed this free-form discussion for a very free-form style of film.
Yeah, we've done it in the style of the movies. Yeah. We won't be doing that again.
Just wait till we go into like the interpretive dance films. I can't wait till we go into like our Jadowski season.
Oh, God.
This, as I said, brings us into tonight's show. Thank you as always for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to listen to us. Leave us a review. It all helps raise the profile of the show. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Come say hi to us there. And you can also check out our blog, which is stationcinemafilmclub.wordpress.com, which has got our full archive of episodes, including our theme moms for Takashi Miike and Anthony Wong. We've got our Battle Royale chapter-by-chapter breakdown, as well as other fun stuff on there as well. But Stephen, it's your turn to choose. What would you like to look at?
Okay, so I think we went on quite a journey with this episode, and I think you know it's some dark subject matter. Maybe not dark as we want, but well, I think we're pretty exhausted, and I think we could do with something a little bit lighter. So, and I keep saying it. We're nearly 110 episodes in, mate, and we still haven't done a Filipino film. So I went onto Netflix to see what Filipino films were available to us. So I haven't seen this, but I found a film, and at the time it was released back in 2016, it was one of the most popular Filipino movies of all time. It's an action comedy, which we don't do enough action comedies, do we? It's got terrible reviews, but everybody wanted to see it. So we're going to see The Super Parental Guardians. I think it was just called Super Parental Guardians, and they added a "the" when it went to Netflix. But it looks the kind of low brain nonsense that I think we deserve, mate. And let's try having, you know, let's finally get a Filipino movie on the books. And the fact it's on Netflix makes it easy for us to find.
So, yes, that's obviously on our next episode. But until then, thank you for listening. Thanks to my co-host, Stephen.
Pleasure as always.
Join us next time for Super Parental Guardians. Until then, good night.
の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ月が砕けちっても星が燃えて落ちても踊り続けていたい夜なのさ
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.